Hello, my love.
Hello.
Hello, gorgeous honeys. Welcome back yet again to Straight Up, the pop culture podcast hosted by our journeys, Kathleen and Ellie.
We've had a traumatic last few hours. Well, highs and lows. We have removed a decapitated pigeon from my balcony.
Yeah.
Thank God you were there to help me.
It was a two-man job.
It was headless, guys, and we haven't located the head.
So. And it's really confusing how a headless pigeon has made its way up to this like second floor balcony.
Third floor. Yeah, and lost its head along the way.
Because there's no way a fox could have brought it or anything, so that's a mystery. We've also got some hot debate questions for you guys. We've just spent the last hour debating wedding guest outfits.
Yeah.
Els is off to a wedding in a couple of weeks.
And so I had a dress and I put it on to show Cathers and she told me some cold hard truths. She was like, can you have your abs out at a wedding? So and it's sheer.
We need to know, guys. Yeah, it's sheer. It's sheer. Wedding appropriate. Are abs out appropriate? Because I was leaning towards cutouts for a wedding as maybe a no. But yep. Then I went on to buy rotation and was humbled quickly by the sight of many cutouts in the wedding guest section. So yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. So we'd love to know what you guys think.
We were also debating, can we wear red?
Yes. Is red a no-go for a wedding?
Can you wear black at a wedding?
Again, depends on the setup or the dress code, doesn't it? If it's like black tie. I mean, I've never been to a black tie wedding, so I don't know.
No, me neither. So guys, please let us know. DM us at Straight Up Pod.
We'll do a wedding guest focused poll. Exactly. Since we're getting into the season now. We need to hear your thoughts on all of it.
Urgently, actually, because I'm going to be buying a dress
urgent,
in the
actually.
Next few days.
Very urgent.
Very urgent. Also, where from? Because do I rent it? Where?
Or do you invest in something that you're then going to wear again and again, knowing that you have several weddings this year, but then you don't want to wear the same dress to several weddings in the same year, if you can help it.
Exactly. Also, guys, just for some context, I can't really not wear a bra. So please,
no halter necks suggested, please.
No, unless it's like a tight, you know, it's going to lift those breasts.
Yeah. Well, I did just show you the stick-on bra company that I've heard great things about.
Bumba.
On my wedding dress shopping excursions. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try one of those because so when I last wore tit tape, I had a backless dress and I wore tit tape and I ripped it off after when I was drunk and I had scabs all the way down. Yeah.
Ooh, my goodness. Okay.
Tore my skin off.
So I know we're having a little bit more of a meandering start to this episode, but before we get into the various topics we want to talk about this week, can you give me the highlights of your weekend in Lisbon? Because it looks so gorgeous.
Yes, I can. So guys, I booked a little spontaneous trip to visit my sister. She lives in Lisbon because she got so fed up of British weather. She is a teacher. She can move work wherever, which is so nice. And so she lives in Lisbon and has the most amazing life. Every time I visit her, I'm like, I want to live here. The Uber's so cheap. The drinks are so cheap. Everyone drinks in so much more like responsible way because they just drink like little beers and it's just a great lifestyle. I have three recommendations for you all.
Oh my god, go on. I've not been to Lisbon in years.
Have you not?
I love it. We did a girls trip once. It was absolutely mental because about 15 of us just running around Lisbon like nutters, but it was amazing. And I love the time out food market. So
yes, fun. There's great restaurants, lots of like Middle Eastern restaurants actually, but Portuguese restaurants as well, really good. There's lots of Hindus.
And I can imagine that. Yeah.
The last time I went to Lisbon was for a Hindu and my sister fell from a mezzanine bar onto the bride. It was the funniest thing I have ever seen. So anyway, sorry, tangent. So my three recommendations are, guys, if you're going, Mongolia for brunch, beautiful little cafe on a square.
Is this a special sister reco as well? She must have all the insider tips because she actually lives
there. Yes, she took me there. She was like, this is where I always go for brunch. And I had the best orange wine I've ever had, which I checked you can order here. It's called Crazy Javali, very moderately priced. And it was literally the nicest orange wine I've ever had.
Great.
You can buy it over here. But yes, if you do go to Mongolia, order the croque madame and the pistachio croissant, adored. Then I went to Memo Alfama, which is a 4-star hotel, but they have this really cute terrace that looks over the port and over the river. Me and Annabelle went there for cocktails and it was so cute, so chic. Also, I actually recommend staying in the Alfama neighborhood because it's like the medieval bit with like all the little winding streets and like right by the castle. Do you remember the castle? Did you go there?
I did, but I'm picturing the castle that's like half an hour outside of town with all the beautiful pastel colors and stuff.
You're thinking of the Moorish castle in Sintra.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Oh, stunning. No, this is a castle that's like perched at the top of Lisbon Old Town with beautiful peacocks. Great views. And then finally, for some fun Hindu vibes, I recommend Mama Shelter Rooftop. Great DJ, great views, quite fun to observe all the like hen do's and stag do's. There was a hen do and a stag do going on whilst we were there.
Well, you can't go wrong with a rooftop.
You cannot go wrong with a rooftop. There's so many rooftops in Lisbon.
Gorge.
Oh, it was fab and the weather was great. Oh, and we went to this amazing beach. I'll pop it in the show notes because I won't be able to pronounce it. But like, I actually got a few messages from listeners being like, where the hell is this?
Yeah, that beach looks stunning.
And it's down like the steepest cliff I've ever seen. You go down like 100 steps. And we had lunch on the beach. Annabelle got on the sea. So those are my recommendations.
Fab. Obviously, we'll put them in the show notes so that people have them to come back to for reference. Yes.
And what did you get up to this weekend, my love?
I had a very cute weekend. It was really wholesome. It feels like ages ago now, but I saw a friend in Regent's Park with her little boy, checked out the play area. Didn't know anything about the play area.
Oh, I saw those cute pictures of you and the little child. Epic.
We've got a zip wire in there and everything in Regent's Park.
Wow.
So that was very sweet and lovely. And then I had my mum, stepdad and brother's girlfriend round for Sunday lunch.
What
day
did you make them?
So I whipped up a very nice feast, although I say it myself. The centre of the meal was actually a recipe that I've seen on Instagram that you've liked. So you'll know it because I would have to check it, obviously, to be able to make them. Harissa roast potatoes. So it was like a more summery roast. So I did a roast chicken and then harissa roast potatoes. So that you put them on a bed of like garlic yogurt and parsley and
I liked them, pickled onions over the top. A couple of weeks ago, I think.
So good. Highly recommend.
Kathleen's is a great cook, guys, by the way.
I am. Thank you.
I'm really glad that
Yeah, I'm really passionate about cooking. Like, I actually love it. It's my main hobby, if you know what I mean. I'm genuinely really interested in it. I love discovering new recipes, new food creators, all that jazz.
So. Do you think you could imagine yourself having a farm?
Oh, it's a tricky one, you know, because like, yes, in my idealized dream world, but one of Marlon's friends actually recently moved to a farm and we went and visited him. And after that weekend, it was amazing. We had the best time. It was absolutely beautiful and so lovely to see them living their like wholesome country life, their wholesome Devon life. But we were like, wow, that looks like a lot of work.
It's hard work, isn't it?
Seeing this friend literally having to manually try and kind of pick up sheep and move them around. I was like, that looks not that fun. And then they were telling us about the actual reality of it. So his partner, who of course lives there and works on the farm with him, was telling us just how kind of brutal that rural life really can be, which I know sounds silly and I sound like such a town person saying this, but there's a kind of walled garden part of the farm, which she's now planted loads of flowers in, and she's got like a little like floristry kind of business on the side as well. You know, side note, but as anyone that's seen Jeremy Clarkson's farm show will know, it's very difficult to actually make money from a farm. And rabbits got in and a rabbit built a little nest and there was all these babies and she had to like chop the heads off these baby rabbits with a shovel. Yeah.
Why?
Because they're pests and they're going to eat all the bulbs. You can't have rabbits in there. And once the babies
are in
there.
Did you need to chop their heads off as a way of
going? Well, she said, yeah, I know. I was like, really? She said it was awful. There were points where they felt last winter in the brutal parts like, oh my God, is this actually for us? Because we're having to send off our sheep to be killed and turned into lamb steaks and, you know, kind of seeing the raw nature of it, I suppose. But the rabbits, if you just left the baby rabbits out, like if you move them from the den, they'll literally just be eaten by birds and have a way more painful death because they'll just get like pecked. And, you know, they were too small, the baby rabbits, to actually go off and
but
do anything.
It's chopping the heads off the quickest way
to
go.
Yeah, that's actually weirdly the kindest way to do it.
Oh my God. Yeah.
All this to say, after that weekend, I was like, maybe I'll just have a vegetable plot.
Yeah.
And that'll be enough in my garden. I don't think I can handle managing like acres and animals, I mean, and all the rest of
we
it.
We had to do, it was a two-man job just getting a decapitated pigeon off the balcony.
Exactly. So, yeah, that said, I would absolutely love to grow all my own vegetables. That's like a massive pipe dream of mine.
I could also imagine you as a really great pub landlord. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, one of our dreams is to have a restaurant or a cafe or a bar or no, not a bar, but something. Yeah.
A really healthy cafe.
Yeah. But again, lots of work. Everyone that I know that actually is in hospitality is like, do not start a small business in hospitality. So.
Yeah. We had a friend, well, a friend of a friend who had a bar and he had to shut it down.
Yeah. Not to be a Debbie Downer.
Not to be a hater.
No, I mean, it would be amazing.
It also really reminds me of Bridesmaids when poor Annie has to close her cupcake business.
Niche, but yes.
Apparently Kristen Wiig is not very nice.
I could totally see that. Wild conjecture, but that really feels like it would be true.
Which is really upsetting because her with the tiny hands on SNL is my favourite SNL sketch.
Oh, there we go. Back to SNL again. As if you watch it, like, which you literally don't. Have you ever sat and watched a full episode of Saturday Night Live
literally
in your life?
Never. Yes. I only watch YouTube clips. Yes. But the tiny hand Kristen wig is so funny. But yeah, I'm really, it's a shame because I would love to be friends with her. I also wanted to tell you, Cathers, that I spent much of my day in Lisbon because I had a first day when Annabelle was at work where I just had to take care of myself. And I mean, entertain myself. I went to a fantastic bookshop. A British woman has opened a bookshop in Lisbon called Salted Books. Highly recommend. And I bought myself a book called Arrangements in Blue, which I will talk about in the next episode. And as I was mooching around Lisbon in the fog and rain, it then did get much better. But the first day was bad. I listened to the whole of Tortured Poets Department by Taylor Swift.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
What's your verdict?
My favourite songs are I Can Fix Him, No Really I Can. So Long London.
Yeah, I like that one.
Florida.
Yes.
Who's Afraid of Little Old Me?
So, a quarter of the album.
Basically all the sad, angry ones.
You're channeling those vibes.
The ones where she's all like lovey-dovey and like a bit cringe, I'm not into.
I'm finding all the reviews quite funny because I do think that while it's incredible that she's this real storyteller, it is a little bit tragic that she's released a thinly veiled rehash of the drama between her and Kim Kardashian, which, funnily enough, we literally
7 years.
Weird that we actually talked about that on the podcast. You just said 7 years, but it's been 84 years.
I know. Yeah. I was thinking of that as I said it.
Titanic reference, guys, if you don't know.
She's one petty girl.
Yes. Yes. Basically, yes. I mean, fair enough to use your own life for material.
Yes. And Matty Healy does sound like a little prick.
Also, kind of awkward to release this whole album about previous relationships when she's front and centre with Travis Kelce.
I know.
Happy ever after right
now. If I was him, I'd be quaking in my little football boots because...
Very large football boots.
Very large. Because you're next, hon, if you don't play your cards right. And he's an actual fan. He's a fan.
Yeah, because he always liked her music previously, didn't he?
So it's particularly savage for him. Guys, can someone who's a massive Swiftie tell me the meaning of the lyrics on So Long London, where she says, I founded the club she's heard so many great things about or something? Does it, because So Long London is about Joe Alwyn. Was there another girl? As in, what's the club and who's she?
But don't you think that that's part of the kind of absurdity of all of this, that everyone reads every word she says as literal, when actually it's a creative output that could easily have been carefully crafted rather than being a total reflection of the truth?
Yeah, I was talking to someone in Lisbon about it and he was like, oh yeah, I need to go and read the lyrics, but he hadn't listened to the album yet. I was like,
that's catch up on all my Taylor Swift gossip.
Yeah, so you like read it before you listen to it. Yeah, it's interesting that the lyrics are more important than the sound.
Paste ran their review without a byline because they were so worried about fan harassment.
Coward.
Well, to be fair to them, it's because the review was slightly unfavourable, and when they last reviewed one of her albums in an unfavourable way, I think it was Reputation, the writer got loads of death threats.
I know, I do understand, but then it's just set such a terrible precedent. I remember, I've talked about this on the podcast before, I think it was Billboard who got like a K-pop fan to review it instead of a journalist because they were scared, to be honest, essentially. What was the, what did you say the magazine was called?
Paste. Which didn't ring a massive bell to me straight away anyway. Like, who even is Paste? Not to be a hater. I genuinely just wasn't sure in the moment.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely not the kind of thing any like big reputable title would do. But then again, Billboard hired a K-pop stan, so I don't know. I mean, music journalism's gone to the dogs, I think.
I did actually read a fun piece about the power of the Swiftie fan base, the Swiftverse, in the Wall Street Journal, which just felt very on brand for us, which was about Taylor's publicist, Tree Payne. So headline being, there are plenty of power publicists, but only one works for Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
And she's a very enigmatic figure. She's actually a little bit like Taylor in terms of keeping her personal life very private. So that we don't know like too much about her, but she is the reason really that Taylor has the reputation she has. She's really helped her to kind of rehabilitate it over the years. I found it fascinating how the piece plots her various responses to different kind of crises or moments. It actually opens with a story about Taylor's dad as well. So recently there was an altercation that kind of had all the makings of a PR disaster in that Taylor Swift's dad who is 71 years old, allegedly assaulted a 51-year-old photographer while disembarking a yacht with Taylor, like, nearby, witnessing the whole thing, hiding under an umbrella. So
Taylor was hiding under an umbrella. Oh, sorry, no, the photographer was hiding under an
umbrella. No, Taylor was, yes, nearby. So she was there. So, of course, you know, altercation with paparazzi, being by a super yacht, Taylor saying, like, all of that could have been, like, a really big negative story.
Yes, I did read this. I remember reading the news line at the time.
Yeah, it was at the end of the Australian leg of her Eras tour, and Tree basically masterminded a very clever response. She did a statement not refuting the TMZ story that had run about this, but added surrounding evidence showing that Taylor's dad was actually just protecting Taylor from, like, aggressive men. So it's kind of exculpatory fact that was like, yes, this did happen, but this is why, which was quite a clever tactic. And then lo and behold, a picture miraculously appears of Taylor's dad handing out sandwiches to fans in Sydney.
Ah,
yes.
That is a very smart move.
So Tree Payne has worked for Taylor for 10 years. She's actually her only client, as in Taylor is Tree's only client, which we know, working in the industry, that's quite unusual. Usually yes. A publicist will work across several clients. She's solely focused just on Taylor.
But if you're making that much, releasing that much music.
Well, you'd have to.
You'd have to.
But she has really guided her through all these various moments over the last 10 years, as I just touched on. So she's kind of transformed Taylor's image from this boy crazy young singer to a girl's girl with the squad. One of the kind of tidbits that I found juiciest was the mention that some fans speculate that Tree Payne sent Taylor to Travis Kelce's regular season game against the New York Jets in October just so their internet searches for Taylor Swift Jets would return cheery images of Swift dancing in a VIP suite with Blake Lively instead of stats about CO2 emissions. How clever is that?
Oh my God. That is impressive.
Isn't it?
Wow. Mad. Yep. I mean, that makes a lot of sense as well.
It does, doesn't it? So yeah, Tree Payne.
Go Tree.
Go Tree.
Tree. Now, what kind of, where's that from as a name?
I think it's short for Treza.
Ah, okay. Fine.
But she's beloved in the Swiftverse. So it's she very is. Like, the devil works hard, but Tree Payne works harder type of vibes.
Yeah, the number of times my friend Cleo has brought up Tree Payne.
She's beloved by the fans.
Because she's always like, oh my God, what are your interactions with Tree Payne? And I'm like, no, it doesn't work like that because she's a US publicist. Actually, I deal with a UK publicist. Well, you kind of realise all these US stars that have British publicists, the British publicists have no power. You realise?
Yes.
They're just working for the US publicist.
Well, I remember once chatting to the former publicist of Diplo, and we were at the Brits. So we were chatting about it literally on the kind of side of the red carpet. And I obviously assumed that they would almost be friends. And he was like, oh, no, Diplo does not know who I am. I genuinely don't think he knows my name. Wow. Because he's just like a sea of people of the London team. Like there's so many different like team members around you all the time.
Talking of people that have assaulted photographers, did you see last month Jacob Elordi punched a photographer?
No.
So.
No, I did see that. Sorry, yes. There was also an incident at Victoria Beckham's 50th. Over the weekend, no one punched any photographers, but a photographer fell over and Tom Cruise helped him up. How sweet of Tom Cruise.
I'm sure
he's quite a strange person, giving all the Scientology stuff, but not even going to go there. What I'm actually going to say is the headline I saw about Tom, who I believe is 61, was that he did the splits.
Oh my God.
So, honeys, if you didn't see, Victoria Beckham celebrated her 50th at Members Club Oswald's in London over the weekend with 100 guests for dinner and dancing.
I've never seen a man do the splits.
Have you not?
No, I must have done on stage.
Must have. Yeah.
How does that work with your, do you,
any male gymnasts listening, do let us know.
Tom Cruise, I heard the weirdest rumor about him the other day, which I can't say on air, but it included a forest, it included someone being paid to chase him through a forest.
Also, there was a little Spice Girls reunion moment. The five of them sang Stop for the guests. David filmed it.
Love that.
Also, how cute, when they left at 2:30 in the morning, the Beckhams, David piggybacked Victoria out to the car. She was wearing sunglasses. Love that for
her. My God, I love that.
Yeah, I mean, she has got a foot injury at the moment, so she'd gone on crutches, but it was just funny that she did need a little bit of help getting home.
Yeah. I wonder if they're... Because having wildly speculated that they were living their own private lives and having separate relationships, now they seem
I just don't think they are. No. I think they definitely are pretty happy together.
Yeah.
I've come full circle.
Full circle.
God, Harper, she looks stunning, but I cannot believe she's only 12. She looks chicer than you or I will ever look. I'm sorry
to
say.
Wow, bring me down with you there, Peppers.
Like, you would be so lucky as to get a wedding guest outfit that looked like
Brooke. Is that just because you've seen me in my cutouts?
No, I mean, she was wearing white, so I'm being ridiculous. You obviously couldn't wear it for a wedding, God. But no, she looks so chic. I can't deal with the fact that she's 12.
Okay, hang on, I'm looking now. Oh my gosh.
12.
Wow. Yeah.
No Nicola Ann Peltz Beckham in sight, unfortunately.
Very interesting, because they were so chummy at the premiere for Lola in February.
Yes.
Her and Victoria, I mean.
The whole fan was out to support her, wasn't they? Weren't they?
They were, along with Elon Musk.
I know, who a listener pointed out to us the other day, had said specifically that he went to network.
Yes, he said, I'm just here with friends thinking about what companies to acquire, i.e. Disney.
Of course, Nicola Peltz Beckham's dad, Nelson, is a billionaire himself.
Yeah, and I think a shareholder for Disney. And I think maybe Elon is trying to get in on Disney.
Gosh.
Which is alarming. Anyway, so I think we should talk about Lola. I wouldn't recommend it, guys. And it's not even out in the UK. But I think it's a very interesting talking point.
How did you watch it?
On Illegally.
Oh, sneaky. Okay.
Yeah.
So, for the honeys that don't know, please could you give a synopsis and background on Lola?
Okay. So Lola is Nicola Peltz Beckham's directorial and writing debut. It's about a 19-year-old working class woman in America who works part-time in a strip club. She has a cruel alcoholic mother who bullies her genderqueer sibling. And Lola is raped by her mum's boyfriend. She then gets pregnant after the rape and chooses to have the child. Then her brother, Arlo, is hit by a car and killed after her mum makes him cut off his hair.
Yeah, so I read that the major issue people are having with this film is that it's poverty porn.
Yes, it's Nicola Peltz Beckham cosplaying a poor person.
Having absolutely no idea
what it feels like.
Yeah, the criticism I saw takes those plot points that you just mentioned and says that it's this ridiculous catch-all story of various kind of traumas that people living in poverty might go through without any actual narrative sense.
Exactly. And also people pointed out that Nicola's dad, Nelson, has like funded American politicians who are anti-trans and anti-gay. And one of the main plot points of the film is Arlo, Lola's little brother, is gender fluid. So it's like, it's just a lot of...
Feels a bit hypocritical. It feels very hypocritical. That mantle.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it just feels like you've literally thought of every traumatic thing that could happen in a working class American woman's life and then put it all in a film.
That.
Exactly. Like when I was reading out this plot point, I was like, this is ridiculous. All of this happening to one person in one film. And there have been some really funny reviews. There was one by Katie Ruth Ashcroft in The Guardian that opened with a very snarky line. If a Nepo baby makes a laughably oblique film portraying what she must imagine to be the strife of the impoverished class, but hardly anyone watches it, will it hurt her career? So I would say that watching it as well, like, it generally does feel, and the writer says this as well, that it's like a glorified advert for Nicola Peltz Beckham being really hot. Like,
oh my God.
All the shots are just like her, like with her perfect makeup, like looking like sadly out of a window, smoking in a really hot way.
Apparently she's been working on it for 6 years.
Yes. So she said she wrote it in a 3-day writing binge. She said she didn't sleep for 3 days. She wrote it when she was 23 years old. She's now 29. And she has said about it that she wanted to write a story from a person's perspective and another point of view that was not my personal view and not my upbringing. I am an actress and my dream is to get to look at the world from different perspectives.
Well, fair, but then bring on a co-writer who actually has experience of those things.
Yeah, she keeps talking in her like press runs of like, oh, like I have a friend who has experienced some of this. I mean, it's difficult because I don't think that we should only make art that reflects our lived experience. I think that's
very limiting if people can only make art based on what they have actually lived.
But also, I do think that you have to be quite sensitive.
Yeah, you have to be really aware. Okay, gang, I've just got back from Mexico and I need to tell you about how amazing it was to be able to bring my London Nootropics adaptogenic coffee sachets there with me. You all know by now how much we love London Nootropics, but honestly, you honeys that haven't yet tried it have got to stock up before the summer holidays because I promise you will be converted.
And we have a discount code, so keep listening.
We do. So I packed about 30 sachets for Marlon and I for our 2-week holiday and it was honestly absolute heaven having one every morning, sat on the balcony reading while the Airbnb instant sat sadly in the corner. It also made me feel so good in myself every day.
Stunning. I am definitely going to do the same when I also go to Mexico later in the year. Which blends did you bring, babe?
I actually brought a mix so we could choose each day depending on our mood. Guys, if you don't know, then adaptogens are basically natural plant extracts that massively enhance our well-being, and each London Nootropics blend utilizes different ingredients of the absolute highest quality for different purposes. My OG favors Flow. You all know I love Lion's Mane, but I wanted to have enough for those days while also bring Mojo because it's so helpful. The cordyceps in it is shown to rapidly reset our body clock, and so it really, really helps with jet lag.
You know that's my absolute fave. I literally cannot go to the gym without it anymore.
I also brought the Calm blend with L-theanine for the mornings when I've had a few too many margs the night before and was feeling a little bit anxious, so that was very handy, can't lie.
Classic. Guys, upgrade your coffee game like us at londonnootropics.co.uk using the code STRAIGHTUP, all one word, no caps, for 20% off at checkout.
Thank you so much to our amazing partner, London Nootropics.
I did also read a piece that was like, okay, Ken Loach is famous for making films about like authentic working class life in parts of England. And he studied at Oxford and lives in Hampstead. And also every actor at some point, like Tom Cruise, we probably would feel fine with him representing a very deprived man on screen, but he's like one of the richest men in Hollywood now.
I definitely know what you're saying. But I do think if you're going to make a film that is about an experience to which you've never had any insight on, then you need to bring other collaborators on board so that you do reflect the kind of truth of the situation.
Yes. And I do think also helps if it's a good film. And also it helps if it doesn't so blatantly look like a vanity project.
Yeah. And there's just no excuse. As the Guardian reviewer you mentioned before said, it's filled to the brim with underbaked, oftentimes harmful tropes. The film leaves one wondering what could have been achieved if any of these characters or their storylines were given as much attention as the gaffers paid to the lighting hitting Peltz-Beckham's cheekbones.
Yes. There were so many like soft focus shots of Nicola Peltz-Beckham looking stunning. And also I think in another piece, someone was like, I don't think she cares that the reviews haven't been good because she's had a successful press run and she's like had her vanity project. Like she's been interviewed by all the major magazines.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things I found most interesting about the Guardian piece was her pointing to how very few people have called out Peltz-Beckham's leverage of the aesthetics of poverty, as well as sex work and queer suffering to serve her creative reputation. So she says, the majority of the press surrounding Lola handles the 29-year-old with kid gloves. You should be so proud of yourself, an interviewer at The Hollywood Reporter offered. Kelly Clarkson softballed her questions about how fun it must have been to bring her mum and husband on set. Vogue's coverage of La Lola premiere glossed over the contents of the film and celebrated instead what Peltz-Beckham wore, Victoria Beckham's designs, and how the after party was decorated like a strip club. Well, even that feels a bit unsavoury, doesn't it?
Yes, The Hollywood Reporter piece is hilarious. Like, all the questions are just so simpering, and there's even a picture of, like, Elon Musk with Nelson Peltz-Beckham and Nicola, and then the caption is like sponsored by Don Julio tequila.
What?
It's like, why have you got like sponsored picture? Was it a sponsored piece? Basically, it made me think there's no way a
someone's making some
journalist.
Money out of this.
Yeah, it feels like it was a whole sponsored piece.
Ooh.
But there is a very funny quote in that piece where she talks about cutting Brooklyn Beckham's one word. So Brooklyn Beckham,
he was meant to be in it.
Yeah,
thought he was too bad.
Yes,
he ended up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah,
he must have been really bad, really for bad. Them to have to do that.
But she, and I think maybe she is quite funny because the quote is really funny. I'll read it out to you. So the journalist says, you know, it was really a nice surprise to see your brother Will Peltz pop up in a quick scene. Side note, that quick scene is at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting where his character flirts with Lola.
Yeah, what the hell? That's such strange casting. Again, as actors, you are, of course, meant to be like representing something imaginative, but to have a brother and sister with a romantic edge,
yeah,
bit feels weird. Strange.
And also, do you need to cast your brother husband in your film?
Why don't you just cast someone else to play a vague love interest of yours in a film rather than your own brother?
And also she kept making a point of how like it's an independently produced film, so budgets were tight, we could only do like 3 takes. I am sorry, if you wanted to have more budget, it's there.
And did it need to take 6 years?
Yeah.
Like
exactly. So the journalist asks about Will Peltz's little cameo, and then she talks about Brooklyn, and she says, Brooklyn is actually really upset that he did get cut from his one little cameo. He had one line, hi.
Hi.
But he kept saying it in a British accent and he was staring directly into the camera. I was like, oh God, we have to move on. Good Lord. So Brooklyn ended up on the chopping block, but I couldn't have done any of this without him because he was such a massive support to me.
Oh my God.
But not even a sentence, a single word.
Sorry, but that just makes me think of your hilarious story from when you had to hold up signs saying, hi, I'm Brooklyn Beckham. So he could read that off a board. Hi, I'm Brooklyn Beckham.
Yeah, guys, he was doing a Vogue shoot. I'm sure I have told this.
You have, and it's really annoying because I don't know where the episode is. So sorry, you're going to have to tell again quickly.
I know. I'm going to do a Stephen Bartlett. I'm going to tell my anecdote 10 times. So I was an intern at Vogue, and which, by the way, is where I shared a chair and shared a computer with my friend Olivia Petter.
Absolutely horrific.
Unhinged. I remember in the exit interview saying to the managing editor, she was like, anything we could improve for next time? And I was like, I do think having our own chair
would be great.
She's like, yes, we've been told that many times.
We are working on that.
I was like, fucking hell, how many more times does it need to be said? That's ridiculous. So I was at a photo shoot with Brooklyn Beckham, and I think it was like a photo shoot with Polaroid or something, and he had to talk about his interest in photography. That was where it started. That's where the giraffe and elephant pictures, the seeds were sown. Guys, he released a photo book of animals, I think, last year.
No, it was years ago. No.
Oh, was it years
ago? Yeah, it was ages ago.
Oh, my God. Okay.
I think he left photography behind literally years ago, and he's in his chef era these days.
No, he's in his chef era, although I haven't seen his chefing videos for a while. Predict his next side hustle? I can imagine him becoming a designer.
What, like an interior designer?
No, a fashion designer, and like releasing a range of like t-shirts.
I could definitely see that, and he just won't actually design any of them.
No, but he'll like surfer dude t-shirts.
Like, I have a fun, really bitchy fact. It's not even fun, but you know the brand Annie's? Annie's like,
yes.
Love Annie's.
Yes.
Gorgeous clothes.
Stunning.
She does not design those clothes.
You have told me this.
Yes. Qualified fashion designers do it behind closed doors.
Flipping heck.
So there's a lot of that. I mean, people say that that's the issue with Victoria Beckham anyway as well, her brand. She, of course, doesn't design those clothes. So the brand's been such a huge success, but it's slightly under the facade of her actually doing much.
It's like Damien Hirst just employs other artists in a workshop to make his art for him.
Does he?
I think so. I heard that.
Cheeky.
Yeah. Anyway, back to my Vogue shoot. Yes, I had to hold up these cue cards for like one. He had one sentence, which was, Instagram can be fun, but don't forget to look up from time to time. I can't believe I still remember that after all this.
You remember it, yeah. And Brooklyn couldn't.
And he had like literally like 10 takes. And then eventually was like, I've got it. You don't need to hold up the cue cards. By the way, the cue cards, it's like one word on each cue card. And he's like, I've got it. And then he tried it without my help. And we had to bring back the cue cards. And I was like, flipping heck.
Oh, I do feel a bit sorry for him.
I think, though, he's a nice man.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he's a lovely, sweet, average.
Not to be a hater, but anyway, I think they're very happy together. Will they last? I don't think so. I think she'll divorce him.
Well, they got married at like 22, right?
So. Yeah, so by the time she's 30, she'll have divorced him.
I think so. She'll be on to her second husband by then.
Yeah, yeah. He will be heartbroken.
Yes.
And then David will set him up with a family friend. He is so the kind of person that gets set up with family friends by his own parents.
Definitely.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, because use your network, but yeah.
You know how you were asking me just at the beginning of whether I'd ever have a farm? I have this theory that really all humans would ideally love to live that kind of life, because if you look at all really rich, like successful, famous people, they usually live that kind of life. So look at David with his chickens and his bees. He wants to be farmer.
That's
Beck.
True.
Yeah. So I think it's the kind of life that all of us, most of us, I should say, slightly aspire to if we had the money, the freedom, the space,
the wherewithal.
I doubt David's mucking out the chickens at 6 a.m.
No, sure, exactly.
He's collecting the eggs as when he feels like it.
He is an OCD cleaner,
so he might be applying that to the chicken coops.
He might be mucking out.
I would love to have chickens one day. How cute would that be? Or would you hate it? I feel like maybe you wouldn't like that, actually, now I say it out loud.
I don't know. I think I wouldn't want to see the foxes decapitate them. Sorry.
Sorry, maybe we're getting too into what foxes may or may not do based on our pigeon trauma from this morning.
We've said the word decapitated 3 times on this episode.
Sorry about that, guys.
Right.
Do you have anything else to say on Lola?
Do I have anything else to say on Lola? No, I would say don't worry about watching it. It's not good. It's not...
Not even worth a hate watch.
Not even worth a hate watch. And I think Nicola Peltz-Beckham needs to... I mean, she wasn't even really doing acting before. I mean, she's been acting since she was 11, but
yeah,
on like tiny things.
Yeah, they always call her an
actor. I would say maybe she's a better actor than she is a writer. Yeah.
Do you think she didn't go to Vicky Beck's 50th because she's too embarrassed post all of these horrific reviews?
Do you think...
Well, I don't know.
I think that kind of celebrity doesn't... I think that kind of celebrity receives so much praise from her like circle that she will just think critics didn't get the artistic vision.
Yeah, and she'll never even get what's so problematic about the poverty porn piece.
No, the fact that she didn't even answer that question properly.
Disconnected from it.
Whilst I was looking at the reviews, for some reason, it led me down a rabbit hole of looking at all the legal documents from the... from her dad suing those wedding planners, and all their WhatsApp conversations are on there.
Ooh.
So all the wedding planning WhatsApp group, all their messages are in those legal documents, and I spent a long time looking at them. I don't know why.
We did cover that big old wedding fallout in the podcast. Did. It was allegedly one of the plot points of Nicola and Victoria Beckham's falling out.
Exactly. And there were two interesting things from the messages that I saw. One, she was insistent on Ron DeSantis being removed from the guest list. So her dad had put loads of his political chums on there.
Right.
And she was beefing, constantly being like, I need to make sure Ron DeSantis is off the guest list. Like so many times. And the wedding planner kept being like, yes, Nicola, I have told you he is off all your dad's. Oh, and then Nicola says, my publicist says that that she needs to vet all politicians. Anyone with political affiliations needs to be vetted by my publicist. So clearly she was like, really thinking about her personal PR.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. And then the second thing was that I just thought the way she spoke to everyone on the group chat was really rude.
Oh, I remember that. It was incredibly rude.
And she kept, and she kept being like, can you, because they were needed to send an email out to all the guests saying no plus ones because the like security is so tight. And Nicola was being like, send it right now. And the wedding planner had to be like, no one's going to read an email at 8 p.m. So it's best if we schedule it for the morning. And Nicola was like, I don't understand why. Like just so
bratty. Didn't she often text in caps as well? Like shouting digitally down the phone at the wedding planners.
And like no punctuation. I sometimes don't use punctuation on WhatsApp, but like it's just not very respectful, I think, when you're like trying to...
Especially when you're communicating with like a supplier. Yeah.
Yes. And just constantly repeating the same thing over and over again. And I just really did not like her vibe.
I mean, this is conjecture, but I'm going to guess that she is a little bit of a sheltered brat, generally.
I actually think poor Brooklyn might feel trapped.
I mean, I'm sure she would be the one to figuratively wear the trousers.
She wears them.
Much of the drama around the wedding was apparently rooted in the fact that the Beckhams felt like nobody's in the corner. The Peltzes were on the top table. It was all about them. It was their family affair. And the Beckhams were sidelined and Victoria was not having it.
And for Victoria Beckham to feel like a nobody, she is not having that.
I always do find it quite funny, though, when you see how like status-obsessed celebrities are, even at their level. You know, they are the biggest icons like in Britain, and yet she still has to make her carousel on Instagram from the party feature all the biggest celebrity guests. Like, you know that they just have this need to almost be seen as an A-lister. So yes, Eva Longoria, Tom Cruise, Jason Statham, all of my party, you know, rather than there was pictures with like the kids and a picture with her sister. But I always find that funny, and I've noticed that working in magazines, how people with a personal brand, let's say, or people that have some celebrity post images from events, they always make sure to get the other celebrities in the images, even if they're not close friends.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
And you think that by the time you get to 50, up 30 years of fame, you would not care about those things anymore, but clearly, oh, she does.
Do you want to know another fun celebrity fact that I got from Pop Bitch the other week?
Always.
About Daniel Bedingfield.
Oh, random. Go on then.
When he was first signed to Relentless Records, label staff there used to take phone interviews pretending to be him because they could never predict what crazy shit would end up in print if he did them.
Oh.
Which is something I've heard actually in the industry quite a lot now, is that a lot of crazy stars have their interviews done by their publicists.
Oh.
But like, fans would never realise that. And then there is one, Jo Elvin wrote about this. She was formerly editor of Glamour. And she wrote a really good Substack about this, where she talks about this whole interview with a very, very famous musician, who I actually do know who it is, but I can't say because she didn't say it on the Substack. They'd done the cover shoot, but then the celebrity just like didn't have time to do the interview. So they're like, we have this amazing cover, but no interview to go along with it. And it's like the deadline is fast approaching. We don't have a backup cover. And so her publicist had to do the whole cover interview.
Wow.
As a celebrity.
Did the journalist know?
Yeah.
So it was done in person?
Interviewing the PR. So Jo Elvin had to do it. They had, yeah, she did it, I think, on the phone with the PR.
Oh my goodness.
And she had to, and it's a really funny piece. And the publicist is just like, it will be a better interview from me anyway, because like, they know their client well.
Exactly that. You know, and they're in charge of the narrative. They would be the ones calling if they wanted things cut. Maybe it does make most sense to just kill two birds with one stone and do it yourself.
Yeah. It's on time. It happens on schedule. I actually wonder, though, that there's probably loads of interviews that happen that way and we are none the wiser.
I once didn't have time to do a piece about a British band who had a particular kind of event going on, a live show. And so the publicist did the whole piece for me and submitted it.
Yeah, I love that.
Because I'd said, I'm so sorry, I would cover this, but I just don't have time. And she was like, if I do it, will you run it?
Yeah.
So I was like, sure.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Which probably shouldn't
admit to, but yeah, it was like a Q&A. So yeah. It wasn't anything too crazy at all.
So there's like none of your own interjections anyway.
Exactly. But
it's just like a transcript.
Hats off to her. I was like, wow, that is commitment to getting the story, honey.
That is so funny. Guys, if you're a publicist and you've been complicit in any of such things, let us know. It's hilarious.
I've mentioned this on air before as well. My uncle also is a journalist and he used to work at the Times like years and years ago, and he used to write Tara Palmer Tomkinson's party column.
Oh yes, you have said that. Right, Cathers, the moment we've been waiting for.
I'm so excited.
Can talk about Baby Reindeer.
Eek, I have literally been desperate to discuss Baby Reindeer with you. So we've been saying for a while, actually, that sometimes shows come along that are so no-brainers for the pod that it just makes the prep feel really easy and fun.
Yes.
There's been a bit of a dearth of those kind of shows recently. To have what I would argue is the best show of 2024 to get into.
I would agree with you.
Very exciting. So, honeys, if you don't know, Baby Reindeer landed on Netflix a couple of weeks ago now, and it has risen to the top of the charts to be number one on Netflix in the UK and in the US. It has a 100% score on Rotten Tomatoes, which
is unusual.
If you're anything like me, is a serious sign of something that you've got to watch.
Yeah. 5-star reviews across the board, utterly gripping, amazingly acted.
Richard Gadd is the creator and the lead of the show. It is this deeply shocking series about his personal experience with a female stalker. The show is actually technically a screen adaptation of Richard Gadd's show of the same name, which he put on at Edinburgh Fringe.
Which won him 2 major awards and was like a big deal at the time.
Yes, and it followed his 2016 highly, highly regarded show, Monkey See, Monkey Do, which was about his experiences of sexual assault. He did that as a one-man show. He actually performed it running on a treadmill.
Yes.
Like supposedly running away from a gorilla. It won him the Edinburgh Comedy Award that year in 2016. And it was, as he has said in a Guardian interview, pre-Me Too, sexual assault wasn't really in public conversations, and male sexual assault particularly wasn't. He was 27 at the time, he's now 34. What Baby Reindeer, the Netflix show, does very deftly is it brings together both plays that he's previously written. So it actually brings his experience of sexual assault that he details in that first play into the broader narrative to sort of help you understand the dynamic between he and the woman who in the show is called Martha. Her real name cannot be revealed for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Richard Gadd has also been very clear about the fact that he doesn't want people looking into who the real Martha is. He wanted the show's emotional truth to stand front and center, but he definitely didn't want her to become a kind of target. So they purposefully made the character of Martha very dissimilar in terms of her actual, how she looks and things like that on purpose, because he didn't want the real life Martha to ever be able to recognize herself in the character. Because ultimately he does really make the point that stalking is a mental illness, and he does have a lot of sympathy for Martha and understands that she's someone who's very unwell.
So background, guys, in 2015, he began to be stalked by a woman who was 2 decades older than him. She targeted him for 4 years, during which time she sent him 41,071 emails, 350 hours of voicemail messages, 744 tweets, 106 pages of letters, and 46 Facebook messages. He did eventually get a restraining order out against her.
Well, this is one of the slight discrepancies of the show versus real life. So again, we are giving away many spoilers here, honeys. So if you want to stop listening and go and watch the rest of the series now, do that and come back to this, because we kind of need to talk about all the narrative points to be able to give it a proper review, exactly. I think. So in the show, Martha is convicted and goes to prison. In real life, that isn't what happened. So the matter has been resolved, Richard Gadd has said, but I know that the stalker was not sent to prison as she is in the show. In real life.
Yes. So a little bit of background if you haven't seen it and want to listen to this before you watch the rest. Martha is a very unhappy woman that comes into the pub that Richard Gadd's character Donnie works at during the day. At night, he is a struggling comedian, and she comes in and starts crying in front of him, and he offers her a cup of tea on the house because she says she can't afford it. However, she then becomes very attached to him. This one act of generosity and kindness clearly means so much to her, and from that day onwards, she comes back every single day and spends the whole day at the pub with him during his whole shift, despite telling him she's very busy, she's got to go. She's a high profile lawyer for David Cameron and Nick Clegg. And
there's like absurdly photoshopped images of her standing with various politicians, and she shows him at one point her phone contact book, and it's like Nick Clegg, Tony Blair, Rishi Sunak, I don't know, like a list of just every obvious politician you could ever think of, and she claims that's her phone book. She's definitely a fantasist, and you get that right from the start. Jessica Gunning plays Martha.
She is fantastic.
With aplomb. She is so good, isn't she?
She makes it. She's the best thing in it.
Oh, she is so brilliant. Like, you really get just how scary being the kind of target of something like that would be. I know that sounds ridiculous, but she comes across as a very sinister figure, but also someone that's very unwell, someone that's vulnerable. You know, it's like so complex and layered the way that she actually plays that character.
Yes, and she has said in interviews that she very much didn't want to play Martha as a villain, that she felt a lot of empathy for her. And I have to say, there are scenes in which I actually warmed to her.
Yeah, you feel really sorry for her at times. And so does Richard Gadd, Donnie, the character. And that's part of what makes the relationship so complex. So as you're watching, guys, you kind of feel frustrated by him taking wrong turns at many points. And he takes ages to go to the police. All of these things are explained. But you can kind of recognize that he's not dealing with it in the right way. But that's partly because he feels so incredibly sorry for her. So he often doesn't take her, I suppose, even threats of things like violence that seriously, even though actually she's a very scary and often violent woman.
Yes. And I also think he goes, there's a several times he talks about how amazing her laugh is and how much he wants to make her laugh. And not only do I feel sorry for her, but there are moments where you actually feel like, I quite like you. She's quite funny. She can be quite charming. And I think that's what's so brilliant about the show, is that it's so nuanced. And even at the end, the final scene, I felt so sorry for her. And you can tell Donnie does as well, when she pleads guilty to all 3 charges of stalking and says like, oh, my baby reindeer, my little reindeer. And you just feel like, oh God, are you even a bad person? Like, no, you're just unwell.
Yes. And that's what Richard Gadd really wanted to get at. And what he wanted to explore, I think, was the way as a society we deal with this, whether it's looking at the kind of complete ineptitude of the police and the way they respond to it, and just things like the fact that the police make him go through hundreds of hours of voice notes to find a potential threat so that she could be charged. Well, it never comes to anything anyway, and it re-traumatizes him having to listen to all of that. And so I think it's pointing to the kind of absurdity of the system and how broken it really is.
And also the fact that because he is male, the police don't see her as a physical threat.
Even though she is, as I just said, very violent at times. But they think a woman can't possibly be a physical threat to a man.
Exactly.
You know, recent figures show about 7 million people in England and Wales have been stalked. And I think what the show does so chillingly is it kind of reveals how technological advancement has added fuel to that fire. So in the Edinburgh show, I know that the emails and texts and stuff were all beamed across the ceiling. In the show, you see loads of the emails and you come to recognise Martha's style of writing. And it does feel very sinister, doesn't it? But I saw Richard Gadd in a clip on TikTok, with, I think it was a Netflix interview, say that he would sometimes almost be floored by Jessica Gunn's performance as Martha, because previously he's never had an actor play those roles. So in the Edinburgh show, which was also, both Edinburgh shows were women shows, but the one that was about the stalking experience, Martha was like the stool.
Yes.
And he would do her voices. And so he said in this clip that playing alongside Jessica Gunning and seeing someone for the first time deliver Martha's lines literally took his breath away, because he couldn't believe how perfectly Jessica Gunning was actually encapsulating Martha, even though Jessica Gunning has said that she never looked into the real woman because there wasn't much point, because she wanted to capture it in her kind of own way. And Richard Gadd said it was eerie how similar it
felt. Well, you're so right, though, about the idea of technology giving so much access to people.
Yeah.
This is absolutely not comparable at all, but I have had some strange people like send me obsessive messages in a professional capacity, like on my emails and stuff. And it stresses me out how much I have like public information available out there, like pictures. You know, if you have a public Instagram page or even on Facebook and stuff, I'm like, oh my God, I've given so much of my life away that could be used against me.
Like nefariously. So honeys, if you don't know, well, why would you know this, I suppose? But I should preface that Ellie is, and I mean this in the kindest way possible, a bit of a freak magnet. Like, vulnerable, strange people are definitely drawn to you. You always have weird strangers messaging you constantly online.
Literally, there's a quote in Richard Gadd's character, Donnie, says, "I became a sticking plaster for all of life's weirdos."
And I was mean, like, that's you.
It me.
It is literally you.
It literally is
Can
me.
Can you give some context to the Huns?
Oh, yes. So the other day I said, or like last month I said to Cathers, I was like, I have been in an Instagram DM dialogue with this random man for 2 years and I don't know who he is. And it escalated to the point where he was telling me really intimate stuff about his newborn child, and like, because he was sending me pictures of him and his wife. He was never like coming on to me. I was just like, I have this weird pen pal on Instagram. I don't even follow him. I don't know who he is.
I don't know how you ever got stuck in a back and forth with him in the first place. That's what always astounds me. How on earth you got into a 2-year back and forth with a rando? Because if a rando messages me, I just completely ignore it. It disappears in the message requests. You know, it's like not a back and forth that I've ever even been in.
I know. And actually, one of the most disturbing things, I had to go and report to the Telegraph lawyers, and I won't go into detail because I'm really scared that they'll like, it will like fuel them. And that's the other thing, is that you can fuel these people by then talking about them.
Well, that's what happened to Richard Gadd.
Yeah.
The success of his first play, Monkey See, yes. Monkey Do, is what fueled Martha, the stalker. Him having some kind of professional success as a comedian really like enticed her.
Yes, exactly.
Even though the stalking had actually started prior, it ramped up massively post his first play doing really well.
Cathers, I have been trying a new product from our faves at Innermost that I must tell you about.
Oh my God, yay! First though, a quick side note, honeys, because regular listeners will know that Innermost is the award-winning supplement brand that we've become converts to recently thanks to their amazingly healthy and nutritious proteins that are stocked everywhere from Ocado to John Lewis and Soho House.
Yes, so we both love their plant-based protein, the health protein, which we've been raving about in our last few episodes, but I've since been trying the strong protein as I'm gearing up my weight training for summer, and I am amazed at how smooth and creamy it is.
Ooh, what flavour did you go for?
Strawberry. It's so delicate. Doesn't taste artificial like so many other proteins do, probably because, as well as the 34 grams of whey protein, creatine and magnesium, it also includes Montmorency cherries and bilberries, which help reduce inflammation and support cardiovascular health.
Yum, that sounds amazing. I personally just love how clean Innermost products really are. So this one is cruelty-free, vegetarian, gluten-free, contains no artificial flavours, no fillers, bulking agents or colours. The brand is just super transparent about their ingredients and they're all listed on the website, which I am obsessed with because it's really important, particularly in the kind of health and wellness space.
I definitely agree. I also love that their strength range is being marketed to women. Women who lift are gorgeous and beautiful and should be normalised.
Hell yeah, honey.
So go check out their whole range of products, including their protein powders, at liveinnermost.com.
Thank you so much to Innermost.
So I think what's really good about Baby Reindeer is how he really examines his own sense of complicity, which is, I think, he didn't have to do. And in fact, he said in an interview that there was a version of the script where he comes across very well. And then he was like, no, this is just not fair. And it's not good art, and I'm lying to myself, and it's not going to be a good show, and he rewrote it. And so he really does self-examine how he may have potentially encouraged Martha. And did he also, I mean, what's really clear is that he wanted her validation just as much as she wanted his.
Oh, for sure. He definitely presents himself as a very troubled soul from the outset. And I think he really, like, delicately explores how his own traumas ended up making him make some very questionable choices. So in his relationship, yes. for example, with Terry, the trans woman who he meets online, there are definitely elements of the way he treats her that are pretty unsavory.
Definitely. And I think it's a really, really interesting examination of repeating cycles of trauma. In one scene, he kind of hits a nail on the head when he talks about why he was putting himself in dangerous sexual situations after having been raped. And he says, "I put myself in these fucked up situations almost in an attempt to be raped again so as to understand the first time. Like, if I'm passed around like a whore, I can shed this belief that my body is part of me somehow."
Yeah, it was such a fascinating look at like the psychology of sexual assault.
Yes.
And how you feel, how you can sometimes feel about yourself after being the victim of like a really horrific crime like that.
Also, the scene where he goes back to the house of the man who raped him, even after having done his massive like viral monologue on stage, yeah. having like healed.
And he still wants his approval to some degree. Very Stockholm syndrome-y.
And they agree to work together.
So honeys, if you don't know as well, the show details his experiences as a younger man with a much older, powerful writer in the kind of TV world. So as Ellie said, he's an aspiring comedian. In the show, they show his comedy looks pretty shit, to be honest. Like deeply unfunny, prop-based
I hate comedy. Prop-based comedy.
Like him wearing a hat with a mink on it, saying, "Oh, I have a mink hat," you know, that kind of stuff. And he meets this writer at a swanky party when he's at Edinburgh. This writer becomes interested in him. He feels so flattered by this famous, successful person's attention. He helps him to kind of really polish his show, and it does pretty well in Edinburgh. He then steps away, and Richard Gadd has said this in an interview, "Edinburgh's a strange time because you feel like your show is actually landing and people are loving it. And then the rest of the 11 months of the year, you're like this huge failure where weird stuff just doesn't land."
And also having been to the Fringe, like there is so much goodwill when you go there that like I can imagine kooky shows like his being like very much accepted,
but then they're
not funny when you tour them around London or whatever.
Exactly, for people that have paid 30 quid just to see a kind of obvious, well-known comedian make a few stand-up style jokes.
I have to say, the only times I had to pause the show because I literally was like wincing so much were his comedy scenes. I thought it was bad.
So anyway, Darian in the show is this very successful writer. He's been writing on a show called Cottonmouth, all of course made up, but there are lots of TikTok sleuths at the moment doing digging. Have you seen?
No, what do they think it is?
So just quickly to finish where I was, Darian invites Richard Gadd, Donnie, over to his house many, many times, ostensibly for writing, but actually they become these kind of drug-fueled, very weird weekends where they take everything from like crack and cocaine to heroin to these shots of GHB. These weekends get increasingly more sordid where Richard slash Donnie is out of it and is vaguely aware that this man is sexually assaulting him while he is completely passed out, essentially. And it gets worse and worse and worse. This man is so disgusting, isn't he? The actor encapsulates this horrible, seedy. So what's really horrible about it is the power dynamic. It's the classic casting couch story. This man is tantalizing him with promises of a successful career. He says he's going to help him with his script. He's going to give him notes. He's going to get it commissioned. But really, he's just using him for like these horrible, drug-fueled, non-consensual sexual experiences.
Yeah, it's rank.
And as I said on TikTok, there's so much sleuthing going on, which I'm not sure how I feel about actually, because Richard Gadd has specifically said that he doesn't want people going to look for, for example, the real Martha. And yet there are literally so many videos on TikTok right now, all piecing together who she really is. I'm not going to even say the name because I don't really want to add fuel to that fire, but there's a pretty compelling.
Really?
Yeah. Even though she looks, of course, as he said, different to Martha, similar kind of plot points, i.e. former lawyer, struck off for... So, except, but you know, it does feel like it could well be this particular woman.
I do have to say, you know, when he's like, "Oh, she won't recognize herself," it's like, yeah, but she'll know who you are and she'll know you've done.
Yeah, she's going to know that it's about her, whether or not you've chosen an actress who is a different dress size to the original woman. I feel like
she's going to put two and two together. Yeah.
But anyway, so everyone's trying to look for who the real Darian is as well. And I have seen a very compelling piece of evidence as to who it might be. Again, I don't want to like say the name because I don't want to add fuel to the fire, but go and have a look on TikTok if you want. Even the actor looks similar.
I would say that there is more of a compelling reason for him to be named and shamed because he might be doing it to other people.
Well,
in the
exactly. So he should. And I think, to be fair, Richard Gadd has been clear about not wanting Martha identified because she's mentally unwell.
Yeah.
We don't know how many details he kind of hid about who Darian really is, but a very eminent writer who was the director at Birmingham Theatre has stepped down literally as of several days ago. And he looks very like the actor.
Wow. That's all I'll
say. And he had worked with Richard Gadd on one episode of something around the same time that would like match up with the timeline. I think it was 2012 that they worked on this particular show, because of course all of that happened before his
experience stalking. You're right. Yeah. Oh my God. Fascinating. Okay. I need to go and have a look at that.
I liked a quote from Richard Gadd as well in his Guardian interview where he says, I almost think you could have based on a true story before every show, because all the best shows come from a certain place within someone. It reminded me of what we've said about novelists writing about their personal experiences, particularly for their own first novels. I suppose if anything's ever going to feel truthful, it has to be based in personal experience.
Yes. However, I wondered how you felt about the scene where he finally kind of has his viral moment by baring his soul and telling the whole auditorium about his rape and cycle of abuse and just says everything that's ever happened to him. And that's how he becomes famous. And it just reminded me of the theme that we constantly have in this podcast of people finally becoming successful because they have told the whole world the most intimate, vulnerable details of their darkest traumas.
Yeah, well, it's what made Richard Gadd a success. Yeah. However, I think it is a little bit maybe more nuanced than that here. So in this interview, he does kind of touch on how he was pushed to a point where he just couldn't not be honest about what he'd been through. It was like eating him up. It controlled his entire life, his thought process. He was so anxious. He felt that you could cut a line with a knife and fork through my anxiety. He's quoted saying, I remember cracking up because it was all going so badly. And the producer said, what do you want from this man? And I turned to him with tears in my eyes and said, I just want to make it out alive. Little did I know it would provide a lifeline for me. The way people received that show and received me and accepted what happened to me, it saved my life. It's mad that it happened that way.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I think telling his story has been incredibly cathartic. Cathartic? Cathartic. You know, I have seen lots of people questioning how he could possibly reenact the most traumatic things that have ever happened to him. I've seen survivors say that there's no amount of money or, you know, status that they could be bequeathed that would make them relive those moments with an actor like that again.
God, yeah, it's true. I hadn't even thought about that. But yes, he's genuinely reenacting the rape.
Yeah, but for him, he has felt that it's an important part of his healing.
For all the darkness in the show, there are some very funny moments. And Richard Gadd has said before that, you know, there is no shade without light and vice versa. And he believes that everyone's life is a bit like a comedy drama. And I think that's what makes the show so good, is that like, even during the darker scenes, you laugh at something really tiny, like when Darren is really high going, not the cat bowl. And Donnie's about to be sick in his cat bowl.
See, I didn't find that funny at all. I thought it was really traumatic and awful. I found everything that happened in that flat to be like horrific, but I did find...
Or when he's dancing, like in the weird Amazonian dance, and he's like, I want you to see me as powerful. And he like looks ridiculous.
Yeah, I found him so creepy that I couldn't find humor in any of those scenes, but I did find humor in the pub scenes with the kind of awful male co-workers of his that definitely embrace like toxic masculinity. To bar Martha, there's the jokes about hanging your curtains. I could find comedy there, but there was a great quote at the end of a review, which I felt was quite apt, where they say, inevitably Baby Reindeer makes a stressful and often distressing viewing. In describing it as still piercingly funny, the marketing bods at Netflix are surely the only ones having a laugh, which, yes.
No, but Richard Gadd himself has said that there are lots of funny moments. I think that's them being too po-faced, because
it's like a dark comedy. Yes, I see that. But
he is definitely adding like moments of comic levity, and that's why I think why it works so well. As he said, you can't have light without shade, vice versa. It bounces off each other so well. And also, you're meant to feel unsettled, I think, as well. There's also the really funny bit when the dad is like shouts himself hoarse.
Yeah, Martha. That is quite funny. Like, the poor dad.
Yeah. And like, that is clearly meant to be funny.
That is all based on an emotional truth again, though. Like, you literally viscerally feel Donnie/Richard's panic when he's racing up to Fife in Scotland to try and get there before Martha does to tell his parents about his sexual assault.
Yeah.
And you really get a sense of how awful it must have been for him living in a culture of silence prior to telling his parents and a monkey see, monkey do being put on, you know, having that kind of false normality. He's mentioned that in an interview, going home for Christmas with his parents not knowing that he had been raped was horrific.
I wonder whether the scene where his dad reveals that he too had been raped by someone in the Catholic Church is drawn from
that he was also a victim of sexual abuse. Yeah, I feel like that isn't, because I don't think he would disclose his dad's personal trauma like that. I thought that was really just a statement about how, you know, fundamentally being a victim of an awful crime like that can fuck with your sense of self, and how he felt like less of a man because of what he'd been through, and his father's essentially saying, do you see me as less of a man?
Definitely.
I felt like that was there to kind of look at masculinity, because the father's a very traditionally kind of masculine man.
I thought it was such a good scene. And also Richard Gadd said to her before sobbing that he has felt his most empowered as a man from being vulnerable.
Exactly.
Which is so nice, I think.
One element of the discourse that I've noticed that I found quite fascinating is, while most people are, of course, celebrating Richard Gadd, his bravery, his astute storytelling, the incredible emotional depth, there are others, you know, kind of pointing to his real life questionable behavior.
Oh, God.
So one woman who is an actor who had actually auditioned for the role of Terry, who is played amazingly by Naba Mao.
So good.
I loved that whole storyline.
Yeah. I loved how perceptive she was as well. Like she was able to completely see through him at every point.
Yeah, I absolutely loved that character. So one actor who had gone up for that role claims that Richard Gadd essentially blurred the boundaries of what's appropriate by asking her out on a date, even though she was auditioning for the show.
Oh, God.
I did, though, go on a bit of a dig on Reddit and stuff to have a look at this. And I'm inclined to agree with commenters that she's slightly reaching, in the sense that, fair enough for you to talk about your personal experience, but much of her statement is about her therapist saying that he has BPD. It's like, is it appropriate to diagnose someone online who your therapist has never met? You know, it was just quite a lot.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing all of this, of course, now. But she basically says she didn't get the role because Netflix wanted a bigger, more recognisable actor for it. Naba Mao being much more recognisable. So she's kind of arguing that Richard's grooming her or reenacting the same cycles of trauma, which the show so cleverly gets at. But I'm not sure, because I think really that what is so deftly done, as we've said, is how much Richard in the show holds himself to account.
Yes.
You know, it's really self-flagellating, looking at every moment where things could have been different if he'd done differently. And he really explores kind of self-hatred and all of that, and looks at all of his kind of worst moments or behaviours. Well, then it's not that shocking, is it? You know, I didn't really feel like a big reveal from this woman. If it's like, yes, he has said that he has like a very complicated relationship to his sexuality, to his own behaviour. I don't know.
Yeah, and he's exactly. Even the scene at the end where his ex-girlfriend Keely comes to see him and he's like been all week locked in his room, like papering his walls with evidence about Martha.
Yeah, he seems completely nuts.
Yeah, and then he's like, I've been categorizing all her voicemails according to the emotion, and it really just show how mad she really was. And then there's this very like funny
where
look.
She's like, oh dear,
you are just as mad, if not worse. And that's Richard Gadd as a creator being very self-aware.
Yeah, it's kind of positioning the relationship between he and Martha as this awful toxic downward spiral where they both were as bad as each other to some degree.
Exactly. And even the final scene where he can't afford his drink and a kindly bartender gives it to him on the house, and it's that same mirrored look of like utter gratefulness.
Yeah, I didn't know how to read that final scene. I'd love to know what you guys all thought. I was chatting to my friend about this literally yesterday, and she said she took it to be like, look at the cycle repeating itself. He's now going to become the stalker. See, I didn't necessarily get that.
I didn't think he was going to become the stalker, but I think it was like, look how easy it is to be in someone else's shoes so quickly. Like, now he can't afford it. And, well, he could afford it because he just lost his wallet. But like, you can never really judge someone because you never know when you're going to be in the same position.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, some people on social media have been like, oh, and now he's going to stalk that man.
But was that what they were getting at? Well, I suppose it was meant to be kind of open, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was more just symbolic.
But honestly, I thought it was so, so brilliantly done. It was so pacey, addictive. While it's dealing with incredibly upsetting and dark, you know, subject matter, it's still like compulsive viewing.
Yes.
Like you can't look away. You want to keep watching. I absolutely loved the kind of the narration, like having Richard Gadd, Donnie, as sort of monologuing over the whole thing really worked for me.
Definitely.
It actually really weirdly reminded me of Moulin Rouge. I know that sounds absolutely unhinged. I don't know if it's just the Scottish accent with Ewan McGregor and, of course, with Richard Gadd, or if there's some element of borrowing, where he is nodding to it in a very kind of oblique way, because it's like the story of an embattled or embittered artist finding his way.
Yeah.
A creative bohemian finding his way in the world, you know?
I know what you mean. I actually also loved Martha's Scottish mannerisms, like her turns of phrase, I thought were really funny.
Baby reindeer.
Oh, God, and when she
talked... reindeer.
Oh, she's very vulgar, and I thought that was very funny.
But she actually was like that in real life as well, you know, because obviously he's based it on all the real life messages, and I think that's partly what was so disconcerting, receiving these really, really sexually aggressive messages. And as you mentioned earlier, that was a big issue with the police, because no one took it seriously that he might be at risk. And in fact, there is a sexual assault.
Yes, there's a sexual assault. One thing that I also found very funny was noticing, I think halfway through the series, when sent from my iPhone suddenly changes. Because at first he's like, oh, she comes with a brick phone to the pub, but every message is sent from her iPhone. And then as she becomes more and more unhinged, you realise she's typing out sent from my iPhone.
Oh my God, I kind of missed that.
And then it's the funniest typos. It's like sent from my iPhone. Sent from my pond. Like, it becomes more and more, she like stops trying to make it seem believable, and watching the sent from my iPhone, it changes every episode.
Oh, I didn't cop the sent from my iPhone. I was noticing all the other typos.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was saying she's got a secret iPhone at home that she never brings out with her, but that she uses for her stalking activities.
No, she doesn't have an iPhone, and she's typing that every time. And it's so funny.
Well, as well as the kind of lawyer narrative, she really claims that she is very wealthy and lives in this big posh house, and he follows her home one day. Very much not the case, but she sees him looking. And that in itself is this awful narrative moment where you're like, oh my God, you idiot, don't let the stalker catch you stalking her.
Yeah, exactly. And she's like so excited by him peeping.
God, yeah. I mean, it's in the vein actually, again, of like, I may destroy you. Or I think it's extraordinary how the most horrifically traumatic experiences in someone's life can be turned into art that has so much resonance and like social good. Like, it's such a brave thing to do.
Yes, and I think particularly when it's so easy to make really neat dramas at the moment that aren't taking risks and don't offend anyone, I thought this was a really brilliant grey area.
Yeah, it felt risky. Much of what's explored is sensitive.
Yeah, I'm pleased usually. That Netflix took it on.
I'm really pleased that Netflix took it on. Apparently, they wanted to take it on straight after seeing it in Edinburgh.
Oh, good.
Another quote from Richard Gadd that speaks to this that I liked was when he talks about how tough it was reenacting some of those scenes and how he could see the props department even were choked up, and even the lighting people. But he says, we all knew that we were pushing towards something that was important. I hope the show has a certain degree of greater good and that it was worth a certain degree of self-sacrifice.
Yes. Okay. So maybe it was harder than harder than he's let on to reenact those traumatic scenes.
Yeah. He says that it was very triggering and difficult, but he has really very much done it to give voice to survivors.
Yeah.
And to really look at the very complicated psychological repercussions of experiencing assaults and I suppose stalking as well.
Definitely. It made me think about the times that I have asked quite kind of flippant questions to celebrities about their craziest fan story.
Yeah, as we think it's like a ha-ha funny, and it's actually not at all.
No, did you see that only last week, Harry Styles' stalker got jailed for 14 weeks?
No.
She sent 8,000 birthday cards to his address in less than a month. Two of them were hand-delivered. Personal address.
Oh my God.
Lots of people that I know in the industry know where Harry Styles lives. And I don't know why I think it's because he's slept with a lot of people. So
I thought the reason everyone knows is because he bought two houses next door to one another in Hampstead and like turned them into a mega mansion.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, like I know, but like the pub he lives next to. I mean, it's so easy to find out where these celebrities live. It's so easy for these stalkers.
Yeah, and that's what Richard Gadd's story touches on, this trail of breadcrumbs that you leave without even meaning to online.
Your digital footprint.
So when she eventually gets his phone number, it's from an out of office, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like these little ways, originally she gets his email address because it's on his comedy website.
I realised that my phone number was because I have a business profile on Instagram, because it's then you can see insights, lots of people do in our industry. But I realised that I had my phone, I was like, how do people keep calling me? And it was because I had my phone number.
Unhinged.
I had like, you could contact me, the contact button had my phone number. I just didn't know
that's
it was there.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So you're like giving out your phone number on Instagram without even meaning to.
Yeah, exactly. But I also, it also made me think of Lily Allen's stalker, which again just started with a tweet, and then he broke into her bedroom and said he wanted to put a knife through her face.
Emily Maitlis had a stalker.
Yeah, which
it happens a lot, doesn't it? Kendall Jenner's had a stalker. I think most celebrities have probably had a stalker. And again, we kind of laugh about it, but actually it's incredibly serious and it's really, really, really scary.
Even, do you remember when we interviewed Sophie Ellis Bexter and we asked her about crazy fans, and there was one story she didn't want to tell us?
Because she had a stalker as well. Yeah, and she said, I just don't even want to go into it.
Because also I think that if the stalker, then you're giving air to her. You're fanning
the flames.
Yeah, because, oh, they're still thinking about me. They're talking about me on a podcast.
Yeah.
All attention is validating to people with that kind of obsession.
But I do think what's so clever about Baby Reindeer is it makes it very obvious that this kind of obsession is a massive mental health issue.
Yes.
It doesn't really seem like a solution just to throw these people in jail.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's why Richard Gadd's character, and I guess Richard Gadd also, was so hesitant to give the most damning evidence to the police, because he's like, well, I haven't reported Darian, the guy who actually raped me, who isn't mentally unwell. So why would I report the person who is mentally unwell?
Who I know is actually just very detached from reality in their own heads at the moment.
Yeah, that final scene where she breaks down in court, I found very, very moving.
Richard Gadd has said that the reason that he didn't pursue it to that level in real life is because he felt too conflicted and uncomfortable about sending someone so clearly very mentally unwell to prison.
Yes, you can. Yeah, I totally see that.
I will be fascinated to see, though, as much as he said the matter's resolved, is the massive popularity of this show going to stoke the flames?
Yes, particularly considering he said that the massive popularity of Monkey See, Monkey Do stoked the flames to begin with.
And this moment of fame, in a way, that he had, that felt like catharsis for the audience at the time also. It felt like, ah, oh, now he's got his big show where he's dealt with his trauma. Great. You know, that we can't tie it up in a neat little bow like that at all. And Baby Reindeer very much shows that to be the case. Martha started stalking his parents, or harassing his parents, maybe is the more appropriate term, after Edinburgh Fringe.
Yes. So good, guys. Give it a watch. Give us your feedback.
To watch it. Loved it so much. Can't wait to hear what you all thought as
well. Yes, send us a DM at ShakeUpPod. Leave us a review on Apple, a rating on Spotify. Vote in our very urgent poll about
very
abs.
Urgent, hard-hitting cultural journalism here, honeys.
Yeah. See you next week, guys.